Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news-ad-free. That's amazon.com/news-ad-free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Many of us have those stubborn pounds that seem impossible to lose, no matter how good we eat or how hard we work out. My solution is PlushCare. PlushCare is a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. They can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Plus, they accept most insurance plans. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss.
One of the most instantly recognisable London events and a fixture in the calendar since the time of King John. The Lord Mayor's Show, now in its 799th year, is all about pageantry and tradition. On today's show, we meet the man who makes it all happen, the Pageant Master. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe, and this is Londonist Out Loud.
Hey baby, let me take you down to a place of strange sights and sound you ain't never seen the light before. Just a stone's throw from your front door. Hey baby, sniff out me, see things of the air, land and the sea, some creep or some saw down the road, jam brand store.
My heart aches for some far off place.
Well, hello, on a rain-soaked morning. I'm looking out onto the Guildhall yard. To my left is the gable end of the church. The stained glass windows there are failing to twinkle in a bit of a half-hearted morning light. The clouds are just clearing. With me is a person who, I was trying to work out what job title to give this man. It's going to take a while if we go that direction, so I'm going to introduce him simply as Dominic Reed, Pageant Master, and we'll unpack it from there. Hi, Dominic.
Hi there. Nice to be with you.
Likewise, yeah, thanks. And we've avoided leaf blowers today. There's a sort of an air of cleaning up going on, not only because it's autumn and there are leaves everywhere and people busying themselves clearing those off the sidewalks around, but also it's the aftermath, the hangover the next morning after the Lord Mayor's Show.
It is indeed, yeah, absolutely. After the Lord Mayor's Show comes the Corporation Dust Cart, and we've just seen the Corporation Leaf Blower, which has been a cause for amusement to both of us, I think, hasn't it? Yeah, no, curiously, there isn't a huge amount of clearing up to do after the Lord Mayor's Show, but there is an aftermath. It's a very intense event, a lot of people in it, a lot of people come to watch it, a lot of effort goes into it. This year it was a great success, so yeah, I think we're all slightly recovering. I'm all recovering really also at the end of a slightly longer year, because I was very deeply involved in the delivery of the Invictus Games, which was another great London event this summer. So that was it's been a good year, but I am looking forward to a break at Christmas time. Yeah,
and your work is by no means finished, because you're off overseas in a couple of days' time.
That's right. Yes, no, I'm going over to Bangalore with the Royal Society, the Royal Society of London for the Promotion of Natural Knowledge. As it should be formally known, with whom I've worked for some time, and they're working with the Jawaharlal Nehru Centre for Advanced Scientific Research in Bangalore to produce the first Commonwealth Science Conference in over 50 years. So that's a very exciting project. And when I come home from that, then I think I might just take a rest. Yeah.
So we've got lots of iconic London events that we could talk about. One of the things, though, that I'm conscious of is that you've spent the last however many months and years promoting the Lord Mayor's Show. I think we've just had the nice round number 799. We're coming up for the 800th next year, I believe.
That's right, yeah. Next year will be the 800th anniversary of the Mayoral Charter, which is what brought the show into being. So before that, you did have mayors. You had mayors from 1189, as everybody knows. Henry Fitzalwin became mayor in 1189, held the post for 24 years. It was the charter that was granted just a month or so before Magna Carta that really reinforced the Londoners' right to elect their own mayor, and it was mayor at that point. It wasn't Lord Mayor. Lord Mayor came in sort of later in the 1500s. Mayor itself was a French word, because we didn't have a word in the language for this head of the common people, this sort of elected figure. But that's what came into being. And the show developed as a mechanism to show this individual, quite literally, to the people and to the sovereign, because the charter makes it clear that the newly elected mayor had to swear an oath of allegiance to the Crown. There was such a power base in the City of London that the Crown couldn't afford for them to be rogue, and so the Lord Mayor had to swear fealty. And that's what happens, and it still happens today. So legislation has successively evolved, and now the City of London Various Powers Act of 1959, Section 5, Paragraph 2, says that the Lord Mayor will swear an oath of allegiance on the second Sunday, on the second Saturday in November in every year, as was formerly accustomed to the Barons of the Exchequer. So off the Lord Mayor goes, and we escort him from his residence, from the Mansion House, the Royal Courts of Justice, to swear an oath of allegiance, and that's what happens. So next year's 800th is the 800th anniversary of that occasion. It's not the 800th actual show, because there have been shows that haven't taken place. We don't have a definitive list of them, though. But things like the plague and the Great Fire, and most recently the funeral of the Duke of Wellington, caused the show to be cancelled. I think certainly the show wound its way through the First World War years, and there's very, very fine evidence of that, 1914, 1915 particularly. What happened in the Second World War is slightly less clear, but the function was fulfilled. So the Lord Mayor did go and fulfil that constitutional function, although we know that the state coach was and most of the city's treasures were taken out of London for safety during the Blitz.
Where did that, was it Cambridge a lot of stuff went to? Where did those things go to?
I'm not entirely sure. I mean, I think they went to a variety of places, but they were dispersed. An awful lot of stuff was dispersed out of London for safety.
I rather like the idea of the state coach in a garage somewhere in Worcestershire or something.
Well, yeah, you say that. I mean, the city owned more than just the state coach. The state coach is in the Museum of London and is there to be seen all year round, and it's fabulous to go and look at. But the city own another group of carriages, and they are stored under the arches of Southwark Bridge, and it is just a lock up under a bridge, and curiously it keeps them in very good condition because the humidity levels are appropriate. I think, I mean, it's obviously what carriages would have, how they would have been stored. So we have two town coaches and we have four chariots, of which we use two.
Now, I know that there is an element of competition in the design of the coach, I suppose, the display of grandeur that was built into its design. But I wondered, as we've pressed the history button, could we say something about the evolution of the tension between monarch and mayor or Lord Mayor?
Well, there are a whole lot of interesting strands to that. I'm probably not the expert, but you've got that early kind of medieval essence where you know one of the signatories of Magna Carta was the Lord Mayor of London, so there's an inherent tension there. There's this charter that's created in order to make sure that there is loyalty between the city and the sovereign. If you look at the sort of things that I do, if you look at the Lord Mayor's show, there's an interesting transition. The earlier pagan festivals, sort of the midsummer celebrations and so forth, and what they call the royal entries, which were royal celebrations, and there is a change in the way that those are handled and the importance that's given to those. I mean, if you want to get into the detail of that, there's a really good book called Pageantry and Power, written by Tracy Hill, which was published only a few years ago, which goes into the history of the early modern Lord Mayor show and talks about that in some detail. But there was clearly, you know, there was this sort of blingy kind of contest about, you know, what was grander and who was better and all the rest of it, which I don't think is the case now. It's much more genteel now than it was.
Well, it also seems to speak, certainly on the part of the monarch, to more of a consciousness of individual power than perhaps we might be ready to recognise in the moods of the present day.
Yeah, I mean, I think nowadays a lot of what we do is symbolic. And actually, the whole of the Lord Mayor show is redolent with symbol, as is state ceremonial. And one of the things that I'm particularly interested in is the way in which the syntax of that is understood. I mean, I think it's very clear that, you know, we talk very glibly, really, in this country about being the best at doing this. One of the reasons we're the best is that we're the last, if we're honest, and that's the point that Eric Hobsbawm makes in The Invention of Tradition, which I think is a very key point. But equally, if you look at every level of a ceremonial event, whether it's the costume, the music, the way in which people pay compliments to one another, the way people stand, move, absolutely everything is part of a structure. And that gives it a coherence. I mean, it's like speaking a language, like speaking in sentences. You take all the punctuation out, you know, you lose all the paragraphs, it becomes gibberish. And the same is true with ceremony. So what we are very good at doing is we're good at understanding it. And I think as a nation, we're a very rules-based nation, and we understand that, and we kind of pick up the codification. And I mean, but I think there's an awful lot that people can learn. There's a huge amount more to be learned about every sort of layer of it, whether, as I said, whether it's the costume, whether it's the any other element, and that's sort of a subject of interest for me.
There's a wonderful Hungarian writer, I think from the 50s, his name escapes him, Mike something or other, who was an immigrant to the UK and wrote about the experience of the English, and he said that even when he's on his own, an Englishman will stand in an orderly queue of one. And that really seems, you look at any bus queue, you'll see that going on. But it makes me wonder whether your job ever seems restrictive to you. You're not at liberty to presumably wipe the canvas clean and come up with whatever function you think best. There's a lot of tradition, there's a lot of stuff that carries over year to year, as you say, a lot of precedence to every move. Is that restrictive?
I don't think it is for me. I mean, I think, you know, I used to boast that I had the last unregulated job in England. I think that, you know, health and safety and all that has seen that to not necessarily be the case any longer. But the wonderful thing about what I do and what I'm allowed to do is that I can be interpretive. If you look at state ceremonial, you're absolutely right. There is a book, there is a rule. You know, it has to conform to a very, very specific and very detailed series of things, one that follows the other. With the Lord Mayor's show, as long as it's coherent, in my view, it's okay. Now, that I think is important, because there's a, you know, the issue with the nature of language is that the people watching it are the important people. If they understand what they're looking at, if it makes sense to them, then you're winning, then it works. They have an appetite for it, it has a relevance, it's conveying a message, it all kind of knits together. If you get to the point where they don't understand what's going on, you've got two choices. You've either got to adapt it so that people do understand. In other words, you've got to reinterpret it so that people can see what's going on. Or you've got to educate people.
And sorry to jump in. What do you mean when you say not understanding what they mean? Because in a case of a procession, a presentation, I wonder how much room there is for misunderstanding.
Well, two points to answer that. One is that if you look at the way that the crowd behave around the Lord Mayor's show, They are an audience that sticks, and they stick because they have a connection with it. That connection is born of a fundamental understanding of the rules. They're not listening to a foreign language; they get it. The story that I, or the example that I would use to illustrate the business about understanding and not understanding, was the issue around the flying of the Royal Standard over Buckingham Palace following the death of Princess Diana, and there was an outcry that it was outrageous that the Royal Standard wasn't being flown at half-mast. That was a genuine feeling born out of a sense of bereavement and what I have, and has to be treated seriously. But the reality is that that flag isn't a flag, it's a symbol of the sovereign. It cannot be flown at half-mast. The Queen is either there or she's not. She's either alive or she's not. Yeah, there is no half measure. So it's illogical in that language to fly it at half mast. So as the famous sort of workaround was that the Union flag was flown, and was flown at half mast. Now, that was a perfect indication of changing the language in order to catch up, so that people understood. People then were satisfied that, okay, yes, due respect was being paid, etc., etc. But, you know, there are two sides to that story, and that's the kind of knife edge on which all this sits. And you can tell by the popularity of events that, like the Lord Mayor Show or Trooping the Colour or State Opening at Parliament, any of those things, you can tell by the fact that they are warmly supported and loved, but we're still on the right side of that tipping point, and people do fundamentally understand it. But I think there's a huge amount of just interesting things that people can pick up, and I think that's a gap that I look forward to filling. I mean, partly through conversations like this, but I think also through the show, through sort of the webcasting that we do and other things, just explaining what it's about, because it is fascinating, and it does have there is a system of logic, and it's not, one's not imposing it on anybody, but it's just, if you want to listen to a beautiful piece of music, if you understand the structure of the music, you appreciate it more deeply. And that's true of classical symphonies, it's true of any other genre. You know, it's, if you've got an understanding and you really get inside it, then you have a greater sense of enjoyment. And I think that's true of what I do.
Do you think there's a bit of a danger that we generally are too ready to believe that we know what we need to know when we encounter something? The idea that there might be something that we have to educate ourselves about in order to appreciate something is rather out of fashion.
Yeah, I mean, that's an interesting point. I think it's out of fashion in some senses, but I think if you look at the appetite that people have for actually learning stuff, I think that tells us that is definitely not the case. I mean, my experience working with the Royal Society was that you underestimate people's appetite for complex, difficult stuff at your peril. People actually really do want to know. People do not wish to be treated as idiots, nor should they be. There's plenty of stuff that a lot of us don't understand, but that doesn't mean you can't offer them the opportunity to do it. And if you look at the success of Brian Cox, for example, you know, what does he do? He deals with really complex issues. He does it in a nice, friendly, open-handed way. You can take as much or leave as much as you want to, but he's not dumbing down. You know, and I think there is a, you know, maybe maybe because there's a sort of a sense that with ceremony, with things that are perceived to be symbolic of grandeur and state, that one shouldn't be talked down to. The reality is there's stuff to learn about it. You know, my great joy is working with people who actually do the making and the doing. You know, if you get alongside a guy who's taking the wheel off a state coach, you know, they can teach you a huge amount, not only about that vehicle, but about the way vehicles are developed over time. It's a fascinating conversation that you have. Same thing's true if you talk to somebody who makes some of the beautiful uniforms and robes and things. You know, there's a real understanding and a craft that goes back generations often, and that's a joy to behold.
I wasn't sure what to expect of you, I must be honest, and of course I'm still working on only slightly more than first impressions. However, my very first impression of you was a picture with the big black hat on, Wellington style. And by the way, I noticed on the same webpage that I was looking at that you're the middle in a family sandwich of people who are previous runners of this event and potential future runners of the event. But that's by the by. But you're an expert in a number of different areas necessarily for this job. You run all sorts of other events, many of them extremely notable, big county fairs as well. So you must be an expert in lots of different geographic areas and lots of different cultural traditions. But you're an architect, and I wondered how you had made this leap.
I am an architect. I mean, I trained as an architect. I practice as an architect, both in India and in this country. And I suppose I regard myself as an architect, or I regard myself as a designer fundamentally. I mean, I remember having an interesting conversation with Marvin Bragg, who regards himself as a writer, not a broadcaster. I mean, it's funny what we think about ourselves in a sense. That's what I did. That was my training. I then went to work with my mother and father, who were both architects, John and Sylvia Reed, who did quite a lot of interesting and very good, in my view, mid-century design. So a lot of their furniture and lighting fittings are quite collectible mid-century objects. Now, they were of a generation of people who came out of the war and really cut their teeth on the Festival of Britain. And the Festival of Britain was, you know, probably the London event to end all London events, really. I mean, it's a fantastic thing. But if you look at the people who were involved in the design and the production of that, you know, it's a list of really interesting people. So pretty much everybody who was everybody in British architecture and design was involved in that. And my parents, as I said, went on to produce furniture and lighting fittings. And when they did that, they were asked to do exhibition work around those products, which they did, and it was from that my father became involved in the Lord Mayor Show from the point of view of it being an exhibition. He did an exhibition here in the city in 1971 called A City for the Whole Man, which was well received, and then he started the Lord Mayor Show in 72 just for 1 year, just to look at it from the perspective of a series of floats and how do you design them and what should they look like. And I still very much care about what it looks like. I don't do a lot of the design myself, although I give a lot of design guidance, and I do personally approve everything that goes into the show. But then, as I said, I went to work with him, and then very sadly, after we'd been working together for about 2 years, he had a heart attack and died very young, died at 66, and I was asked immediately, and by immediately I mean that same morning, by the city if I would take on running the Lord Mayor Show, and I said yes. And that was in 1992, and in 1992 we were really in the grip of the previous recession, and architecture was on its knees, and I was very pleased to take on the Lord Mayor Show. It was a fascinating thing. I felt honoured to do it, and also it was a way of earning a living, if I'm honest, you know. So that's what happened, and then one thing led to another. I haven't, after this conversation, actually, I'm going off to see a former architectural colleague and to keep my sort of contacts and my interest open. I am still very interested in it. I'm very interested in the way that the work that I do, I mean, it sits in the public realm. It sits within architecture. It can't do anything else, and it interacts with it, and I think that's an important element. If you look at the way that, when we were talking earlier, I was talking about the different elements of an event and how they all have a kind of a syntax and a structure. But, I mean, the biggest, clearest structure is where you do stuff. You know, you said, you set the scene for this conversation by saying you're looking out into Guildhall Yard, you're looking at the end of the building, the stained glass window. I mean, architecture defines space. It certainly defines urban space. We in this country have historically had a relaxed attitude to the way in which the public realm has developed, and I think that's changing and more work is going into it. But everything that I do takes place in the public realm. It takes place on the street, in between buildings, and the way in which that works, the way in which you use that space and, you know, inhabit it and respond to it, clearly makes a difference. You know, and you look around and you look at the new buildings. I mean, the amount of change in the city in the years that I've been doing the Lorbeau Show has been profound. It's accelerating. There are a huge number of really exciting things that are going to happen now. So, you know, from the Thomas Heatherwick's Garden Bridge, which is going to suddenly land 7 million people a year on top of the existing Temple Tube station, to the redevelopment of London Wall as a, you know, as a much more public space. There's the whole issue of the redevelopment of the Barbican, the Cultural Hub, the Museum of London. There are, you know, there's the cycle superhighway, all of which is good stuff, but, you know, it's going to have a profound effect on what I call the route, which is where the Lorbeau Show goes. And the Lorbeau Show has been going there, that set route, every year since 1952. So we need to look very carefully at the way that all works. We need to make sure that it's capable of doing both things. And I passionately believe that it is, that public space should be usable and enjoyable for the public. And I think that's a really exciting thing that's beginning to happen in this country now, is that we are actually beginning to get the grasp of that. You know, it's not a question of just putting up barriers to keep people out. It's a question of how do you design space so that you can make it a safe cycle route, but you can also drive an 18th century carriage across it. You know, that's an interesting design problem.
Well, there's two questions that branch off that straight away. One of them is, given that the route hasn't changed in that length of...
If you're struggling to lose weight, you've probably heard about weight loss medications like Wegovy or Zepbound, and you might be wondering if they're right for you. Meet PlushCare, a leading telehealth provider with doctors who are there for you day and night to partner with you in your weight loss journey. If you qualify, they can safely prescribe you medication from the comfort of your own home. To get started, visit plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss. There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at plushcare.com/weightloss. That's plushcare.com/weightloss. plushcare.com/weightloss.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free, or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Time and the architectural landscape has. What sort of things have you got that you're aware of? What sort of changes have you perceived in the set to the parade and I keep wanting to call it a festival. That's completely the wrong word to use, isn't it? The celebration.
Well, I don't know if the festival is the wrong word to use, really. I mean, it's a moving event rather than something that takes place statically in a field with a band and, you know, all that. But no, I think it is a festival. I think it's a celebration fundamentally, it's a celebration of democracy. I mean, it's the last surviving... It is the first evidence of a democratically elected figure, and that's a separate discussion, being shown to the people. I mean, it is a celebration of that ability to elect your representative, and so it does have that. In terms of the route and how it's changed, things have changed over time. I mean, if you look at the changes, there are many. I mean, starting from here where we sort of set off from, if you look out into the yard through the window we're sitting by, you know, you can see that the whole of that yard has been resurfaced and rebuilt. In the time I've known it, you know, buildings have been changed. The Guildhall Art Gallery didn't used to be there. This is, you know, that's a completely new building. The way in which the dance porch is now used, we put a temporary thing on that. You go out into the street, the street's been resurfaced. The whole of Cheapside has, the pavements have been changed. You know, number one, poultry is a new building. We, unfortunately, in my view, avoided having the rather beautiful Mansion House Square because of the public inquiries, and we deal with the curious interactions of geometries that are thrown at us from that. So we no longer use Bartholomew Lane and Threadneedle Street for the Lawmakers Show. We come down Prince's Street. We build a temporary thing there. We have a remodeled junction in front of Mansion House. We have a new piece of temporary structure on the front of Mansion House. That's all going to change because there's been a consultation on how the Mansion House junction will work in the future, and you know, fashions are for, you know, the Tokyo style junction, you know, reduction of street furniture, all of which I think is good, and that will change the way we do that. As I said, you move into Cheapside is now a completely different street. It now has wide boulevard type pavements and a narrower road, which allows people to enjoy it in a different way. So whilst, you know, St Mary-le-Bow has been there since Wren built it, the building next door to it is brand new, the pavement outside it is twice as wide, and suddenly you're dealing with a different experience. And you know, you get to the end there and you've got Jean Nouvel, you know, world-class architect building a shopping centre that in the city, which used to be a red brick mid-century, or, you know, 1930s lawyer's office. And that now fronts onto St Paul's, which is an astonishing, you know, world iconic building, you know, and you've got all of that. You've got a remodeling of all the landscape at the south of St Paul's. The way that we interact with that, with our grandstand, has all changed. I mean, every single element all the way around the route has been looked at, not once during the time I've been doing this job, but many times. And it's in a constant state of evolution.
We're coming up for a break, and we are rumoured to be beset on all sides by crazy people who want to blow us up and do appalling things. And we certainly see prosecutions happening of people who have involvement in schemes and plots. And I wonder what the practical consequences, as far as you can discuss them, are on the Lord Mayor's show. And the other really rather boring question probably is just what the size of resource is that you have at your disposal to make this thing happen.
In terms of the security of the show, I mean, obviously, we all know that we're currently living in a climate where, at the end of August, the Home Secretary put the national threat level up to severe, which is it's back at severe. It's not the first time it's been there, but it's not a particularly comfortable place for anybody to be. It means that an attack is highly likely, that is a situation arguably of our making. That's where we are. If you look at the threats to the Lord Mayor's show, and I can say this because it was, you know, now 2 weekends ago, and it doesn't impact, the threat to the show was moderate. It's two levels down from the national threat level. Now, if you take that literally, it's safer to be at the Lord Mayor's show than it is to be anywhere else. Now, I'm not sure that that's necessarily true. We have a wide variety of different elements involved in the show that could, you know, one might imagine, might attract threat, whether they be military or judicial or police or whatever. But we put a lot of work into making sure that things are safe and secure. So we work very closely with the police and with the security services to ensure public safety. And we take all reasonable steps to do that. We have to be more careful than we used to. Having said that, I took on this job when we were in the middle of a significant threat from Irish Republican terrorism. What's happened is that the landscape has changed. The nature of the threat, as anybody will tell you, has changed from one which was had elements of predictability about it. Certainly, you know, there was a sense that if the IRA were going to do something, they would tell you in advance. There were code words. We all remember all of that. You know, there was a very significant and very real threat, and it was counted in a particular way. Now it's much, much more of a disparate one. I think that's a problem for society as a whole rather than for events. But, you know, there's some very, very troubling things on the internet in terms of, you know, the sort of the radicalization of people, and you know, I think there is, it doesn't matter where you are, there's a possibility that something might happen. Because of the focus that is brought to bear on a public event like the Lord Mayor's Show, there's an awful lot more safety and security in place than there would be, for example, on any average day out going about your business. So I'm not sure it's a more dangerous place to be, but I mean, yeah, it certainly gives us work to do.
Have you had scares?
We've had scares in the past, long in the distant past. I mean, the old phrase that you will be familiar with, there is no specific intelligence to suggest, applies to the Lord Mayor Show and has applied to the Lord Mayor Show for a long time. As I said, it's a disparate threat now. So the chances of any specific intelligence to suggest being brought to bear on something like the Lord Mayor Show, I think, are pretty remote. And obviously, if that were the case, then we would respond to it in a particular way. But we've had all sorts of issues in the past. We've had evidence of IRA plans to disrupt the show and to attack it. Happily, we're not in that place anymore.
And just finally, before we go to the break. And after the break, by the way, I think we're going to do an anti-interview. But before the break, what's the size of your team? What's your tool bag to produce this show?
The team? Well, the year-round administrative team is two people. It's myself and Helen Field, my executive assistant, who is excellent and does a fantastic job. The two of us run the admin and the back office and pull it all together. We work with a broader team, though. You know, we work with a very good team with the City of London Police. We work with people here in Guildhall. We work with the BBC. We work with the military. We work with the Royal Mews. We work with all sorts of people who are experts and very, very good at what they do. And I have a team of about 140 marshals who are all officers in the reserve services, reserve forces, either Army, Navy, Air Force, or Royal Marine, and a lot of them are very experienced, and they come into play to actually run the procession on the day, the mechanics of it. They're not involved, very few of them are involved throughout the year. One or two of them will come to recces and reconnaissance meetings and sort of looking at things in detail on the ground, but most of them won't. But they are they're a great resource. But as I said, it's just the two of us running it year round.
I bet you're ready to expect me being dumbfounded by that.
Yeah, people do look in sort of mild amazement. I mean, I remember lecturing in America once, and to my joy, they said, you know, how many people do you have running? I said, well, I've got two. Actually, they said, do you know how many people we have? I said, no. And they had 900. I mean, they were volunteers. But this was the Tournament of Roses in Pasadena, which is a really big. Well, actually, it's not really big. It's about the same size as the show.
Well, we will be back after this word from our sponsor.
Londonist Out Loud is sponsored by Audible. To claim your free audiobook from a range of 60,000 titles, try the Audible service on 30-day free trial. Audiobooks can be saved as MP3s and played on your compatible phone, tablet, or desktop, or burned to CD, and they're yours to keep. For your free audiobook, go to www.audible.co.uk/Londonist and click through.
You're listening to Londonist Out Loud. I'm in Quentin Wolfe, and with me at Guildhall is Dominic Reid, the pageant master for the Lord Mayor's Show and the convener of many other festivals and shows around the country. So I promised an anti-interview, and there's no question that what we've talked about so far, you have talked about more times than you can count. I wonder how many, just out of curiosity, pick any question from the last half hour. How many times would you say you've been asked it?
And I've been asked that, you know, I have been asked quite a lot of the questions a fair few times. I mean, but that's, you know, people are bound to ask you similar sort of things, I suppose. I mean, the Lord Mayor Show is the one thing on which I get interviewed and talked to about more than anything else. So the reason for that is that I'm the spokesperson, I suppose. I'm the repository of most of the knowledge on the subject. So that's what people want to talk to me about. Curiously, they can't talk to the Lord Mayor, because we're in a position where in the run-up to the Lord Mayor Show, they can't talk to the new Lord Mayor because he's not the Lord Mayor yet, and they can't talk to the old one because they don't want to talk about the new show. And so I end up covering a lot of that off, and that's absolutely fine. I think when you talk about some of the other work that I've done, I mean, for example, I mean the big and interesting things have all been London-based. I would say to the Londonist, I would say that, wouldn't I? But you know, I was involved in running the Oxford-Cambridge boat race. I was involved in the in the Golden Jubilee. I was involved in the state procession for the Golden Jubilee in 2002, and I worked for the Royal Society for their 350th anniversary, which is a remarkable thing to mark as well. And all of that has been London-based. But when you're working on projects like that, you know, you don't want to listen to the organiser. You want to either listen to the athletes, in the case of the boat race, or you want to, you know, there'll be people who are formally authorised to talk on the Jubilee on Royal Matters. And with the Royal Society, you want to hear from the scientists. You want to hear from the real people. I suppose with the Lord Mayor Show, I am the real person, so that's how I end up answering those questions, which I enjoy doing.
Well, yes, I wondered how you keep up that, because even if you didn't enjoy doing it, you still got to do it. You'd surely drive yourself mad if you were sick and tired of it and felt that way all the time, wouldn't you? How do you keep the spirit up when you're not in the mood for answering these questions for the umpteenth time?
Well, the answer to that is, I am into it. I do love it. I don't manufacture it. I don't think I would be able to. And I remember being asked that question by Lady Anne Jenkins, who was the Lady Mayoress of my father's last Lord Mayor. So he was Lord Mayor in 1991, and she's a wonderful woman. She said, "I don't know how you do it, dear. How on earth do you, you know, get the enthusiasm up again?" And that was sort of fairly early on in my tenure. I've now just completed my 23rd Lord Mayor show, and I do genuinely enjoy it. I think one of the great things about it is that it's cyclical. So speaking as a, you know, from my perspective, there's an intensity to the work that builds up to a point which is not intolerable, but it's pretty intense. But then it stops and it goes away, and you can retreat and you can do that. And I think in life, as long as you're able to regroup, as long as you're able to sort of rebuild, then you can do that. For me personally as well, it's a great joy to have done something for a long period of time. I mean, maybe 23 years is taking it to extremes, but I do definitely remember my 14th Lord Mayor show, and I just remember standing in front of it as it passed me, and for the first time thinking, you know, I'm running this now. This is not running me. I'm in charge. My fingers are on the levers here. And I think in modern life it's very much the case that most people will do something for 2 or 3 years and they'll want promotion, or they'll want to go somewhere else, or they want something different. And the great joy in my life is that I get that through the other projects that I do. So, I mean, I have a fascinating time. I'm all over the place doing things, and I do get that sort of 2-3 year cycle. But through the backbone of that has been the Lord Mayor Show. And so you do get... I would preface this next comment by saying I don't consider myself to be wise, but I think it does give you a sort of a wisdom that is would be really difficult to achieve in any other way. Actually doing the same thing for 23 years and it being successful and other people coming into contact with it and working with you on it and then disappearing, and you realizing that actually 23 years down the line, the culture has to be partly because of the way that you have caused it to be, is quite an interesting thing to observe. And you look at it and you think, well, actually, I must have been at least partly responsible for that. But I think also the ability to get away and to sort of decompress and stuff allows you to keep a natural enthusiasm. And I do care passionately about it. I love it. I think it's a great thing to do.
Well, that, yes, putting it away and taking time away from the many different roles. And you talk about the cyclicality, that's a word now, of the Lord Mayor Show. But the same is true, of course, for other festival shows and so forth that happen on a recurring basis. And I suppose in my mind I've got a question along the lines of, what do you wear at home? And clearly you must be working around the year on, if not this project, then the next project. But if we were to strip away the huge work component of your life, who are you? What do you find yourself enthusing about, if not in a work context?
That's a really good question. I mean, there's a lovely quotation from Machiavelli about on his retirement, about how he will go into his room, he will put away the cares of the world, and he will put on regal and curial robes. And it's an interesting one. But no, I think for me, who am I? I don't know. The things I care about. I do care about the sort of things that my work touches on. I do care about, as I said, the structure and language of life. I do think that it's very important that people behave well towards one another, and I think the formalization of that through ceremony is a lesson that people learn and take away. I care very much about design. I care, you know, very much about the way in which people treat one another. What do I do when I'm not working? I do the sort of things that other people do. You know, I do the laundry, I go shopping, I like to sail a boat occasionally, although I have to confess that it hasn't been in the water for 3 years because I've been working too hard and not doing enough sailing. I like being in the open air. I like being with my family, you know. I have a dog. I mean, it's all, you know, fairly normal stuff, really.
I wonder whether there's a danger, because you're having to change gear and change personnel and all these different administrative streams. I wondered if you ever catch yourself thinking, I've taken on just a little bit more than I ought to have done.
Yeah, I mean, I think you do that. I think you do that because you want to do a good job. I mean, you wouldn't survive long doing what I do unless you cared quite deeply about the quality of the delivery, which means that you're always kind of over delivering. You've got to. That's what you're about, and therefore you're bound to take on a bit much. I mean, as I said, it does go in cycles. I mean, I had a year some years ago when I was running the Oxford and Cambridge Boat Race, the Lord Mayor's Show, and doing a big chunk of the Queen's Golden Jubilee. I think my staff increased to a sum total of three that year. But at the end of that, I was, you know, I realised that I'd done quite a lot. I think I'm coming to the end of another year where that's true. I mean, working on the Invictus Games, working with Prince Harry and the team on that has been fantastic and a great privilege. But it was, it was a big commitment to put on a multi-sport, multi-venue games of international quality in 9 months from a standing start in a major city like London was quite interesting, and I came rolling straight out of that into another Lord Mayor Show, and lo and behold, we managed to do a good job of it. So yes, and then I think there are the things that you feel moved to do, outside work. I mean, I'm fortunate to be on the board of the Museum of London, so I'm a governor of the Museum of London, which is a great museum with a great deal of energy. I know I'm talking to a listenership who have a passion for London. I mean, it's a wonderful place and an institution to watch, because I think there's a really superb team there at the moment, and there's lots of exciting stuff going on. So you take on too much, but as the Scots say, you're a long time dead. So you know, you might as well get on with it.
Well, normally at this point in the show, of course, we'd be plugging a forthcoming event, book, website, whatever it might be, but it's a little early to push the 800th. What's on your calendar in London? Oh, that's bad. Sounds like we might need to react to that.
Yeah, we do.
Well, there's a flourish of an ending. Well, by way of a flourish here, just as we're coming to the end of the interview, the fire alarms have gone off here at Guildhall, so we will complete in grand fashion on the sidewalk outside the building. Ordinarily, at this stage in the interview, we would say something about forthcoming events, but the forthcoming event, as far as the Lord Mayor Show goes, could hardly be further away. The 800th, of course, coming up in just a whisker under a year. What's this about Tweed at the Museum of London? What's going on here?
Well, there's a couple of things I'd say. One is that the Tweed, the Museum of London, which is a fantastic place, which I thoroughly encourage everybody to go and have a look. I suggested that what we needed to do is create a special Tweed, a London Tweed, because as you probably know, you know, estates in the country have their own signature Tweed. So I thought we needed a London one, and we created one for the Museum of London, which I was involved in the design of. And now, if you go and see the excellent Sherlock Holmes exhibition that's on at the moment, you can buy a Deerstalker in Museum of London Tweed. I happen to have a three-piece suit in it, but you don't need to go that far. Maybe just buy the cap. The other thing that I really want to mention is that, as you've alluded to, next year will be the 800th anniversary of the Lord Mayor Show, which is really significant, and we're producing a book. It's the first time a book on the Lord Mayor Show has been produced. It's being done by Third Millennium Publishing, and I'm the general editor of it. So that will be on sale. I mean, it's on sale by pre-order at the moment, but it will be published in October. It'll be the first book on the show, and I would recommend it to your listenership. You can get it through either our website, the Lord Mayor Show, lordmayorshow.org, or through Third Millennium.
Well, thanks for taking the time, and you're off to India, so happy travels. When do you get a break?
Hopefully get a break at Christmas. Looking forward to that, I say.
Thanks very much.
Thank you. My heart aches for some fire.
And that's all for this week. My thanks for this week to Dominic Reed. Thanks to Mark Barr and Bernie Barclay. Theme and incidental music was by Songs from the Howling Sea. I'm N. Quentin Wolfe.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.